Reclaiming Christianity, Episode 35, Evolution of the Word, Part 1. Reclaiming Christianity is sponsored by our patrons. Please check us out at patreon.com/John Weldy. Hello again, friends, and welcome back to Reclaiming Christianity, the only Christian podcast where no one works. I'm John Weldy, and I'm just a guy. I am no one of consequence. If you would like to talk back, either with or without pants, you can do so at reclaimingchristianity.net. Or you can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. Would love to have you be a part of this podcast. So this episode is about evolution of the word. We're going to be going through the New Testament through the eyes of this Marcus Borg book, where he puts the New Testament together in chronological order. And it's going to be really cool. I've got a couple great guests. I want to tell you first a little bit about what's going on in the podcast upcoming. Our next episode, we're on a little bit of a hiatus right now, although we've done a couple different things in this hiatus that weren't really planned, but that's okay. But our next episode, episode 35, is going to be Evolution of the Word Part 2, and that's going to be a couple weeks out yet. And then in the month of May, we're going to do a three-episode series on the book Why I Left, Why I Stayed by Tony and Bart Campolo. It's going to be about Bart Campolo. Tony Campolo is evangelical royalty, basically. He's a progressive evangelical, which is not completely a contradiction in term. And his son, Bart, deconverted. He had a very interesting story, and he is no longer a Christian. He calls himself a humanist chaplain, which is an interesting story also. And so the book is about a conversation between the two of them about why I left the church and why I stayed in the church. And we're going to have some people on the podcast that are going to basically have that same conversation. So it should be really good. You can be on the podcast also if you're interested. Like I said before, just check out reclaimingchristianity.net or send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. So today's book, Marcus Borg, one of my favorite theologians, maybe my very favorite theologian, biblical scholar type person. I want to introduce to you a couple people that are going to be on the podcast today. First off, it wouldn't be the same if we didn't have a couple experts that were joining us for this. And so first expert is a seminary student, Jennifer Neihart, who has been with us several times. Jennifer Neihart, how you doing?
Doing okay, Jen.
Awesome. You got a little bit more of your voice back.
A little bit at the moment.
A little bit every day. Jennifer, what's one book that you would recommend to our audience?
It's always hard for me to choose, so I'll just go with something I finished real recently, The Very Worst Missionary, a memoir or whatever by Jamie Wright. That is the full title. She's hilarious, and she tells it like it is, and it's about her own kind of faith journey that she went through, her own kind of deconstruction or whatever, and she's very sarcastic and curses like a sailor, and I love it. And she's really funny.
Nice. So are you going to demonstrate her technique for us?
No, it's not okay. My style, man.
Alrighty then. Alrighty. And then we have Jason Armold. Jason Armold is a United Methodist minister. Jason, welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to be here, John.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So it's nice to have a couple people that have some biblical background when we're actually digging into the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Jason, what's one book that you would recommend? Or maybe what's your favorite biblical book?
Oh, wow. I think The Challenge of Jesus by N.T. Wright. It's absolutely my favorite. Wright.
Okay, so I have not read N.T. Wright, and I'm sorry. I know that I'm a heretic. Mm-hmm. Some people don't say that. So what's special about
N.T. Wright writes from a conservative perspective. However, his lack of dogmatism and his focus on the text itself and its context, I think, makes him leaps and bounds above most conservative scholars. He writes without a tinge of judgment whatsoever.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you do see progressive, I don't know if you'd call them theologians, progressive speakers, progressive thinkers like Rob Bell, that will still reference N.T. Wright from time to time in his bibliographies. Yeah.
And what our author today, Marcus Borg, was great friends with N.T. Wright and wrote a book with him about the life of Jesus from two very different perspectives.
Yes, I think I either saw that one or I picked it up. I've got so many books that I just pick up at half price books because they look interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I've got this great half price bookstore here, and they put them on the clearance aisle. And if I see a book that looks interesting, I just pick it up. And I know what you're talking about. That's one that I definitely need to read at some point. So Jennifer, your book was by Jamie Wright, and this is N.T. Wright. Any connection there?
No connection. No.
At least not that you know of.
Right.
Yeah. Are they both right wing? Terrible. That was terrible. Okay. So first off, we started reading this book together, and this is part one of either 6 or 7 part series. I can't remember off the top of my head how many parts this series is going to have. But we started reading this book together. I think it's 6 because it's 1 per month.
Mm-hmm.
And the book, like I said, is the chronological New Testament. It's the New Testament in chronological order, but not of when events happen. That's how most chronological Bibles are, but rather when the books were written. And I think it's a very interesting way to write the Bible out and just reading through the Bible. So what did you two think of this book?
I am loving the open-endedness of some of the judgments on the canonization of the books and the order in which they were written.
Mm-hmm.
More comes across from, definitely a progressive scholarly end, but he leaves things open. And unlike some scholars on that side, and I would say even one of his friends, John Dominic Crossan, comes across as a bit more dogmatic. Mm-hmm. Moore is happy to want to bridge the gaps between the fundamentalist evangelical camp and the progressive camp. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, Borg always comes
that way.
Yeah, Borg always comes across very humble to me in all of his writing. Anytime that I've seen him speak, videos that I've seen, and there's another one in his ilk, the Jesus Seminar scholars, John Shelby Spong, who I really enjoy. His books are very forceful, but can come across very arrogant and even bitter.
Right.
But I still really enjoy reading him. But the reason that I enjoy Marcus Borg so much, and I say that he's probably my favorite theologian or biblical scholar, is because of that humility that he brings to us.
I noticed that as well. I'm a little more, I think I would say, wary of Borg because I know he is coming from that camp of the Jesus Seminar folks, and I know that I'm not on board with all of that. And so it makes me, I think, a little more critical in an academic sense of what I'm reading, which, we should always take what we're reading with a grain of salt. And, one thing I wish that this book had that it doesn't is footnotes to document the evidence for Borg's claims about the dating of the books, because there's a lot of disagreement amongst scholars. Conservatives will place them a lot closer, to Jesus's life and death, and progressives move it away from it. And there's different motivations. And I wish he would document and give me some leads to chase down on my own to try to fact check him, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think the reason probably that he doesn't do a whole lot of that is because he wants this book to be, as much as possible, wants it just the biblical text, in the translation that he's chosen. And he's got a little bit of commentary on the beginning of each one, and he has some intro commentary at the beginning also. But I don't think he wants it to be a real technical thing. I think he wants to not interrupt the flow of the text as much as possible.
Right. And remind me what translation he is using.
And you'd have to ask me that. I don't remember off the top of my head. It's one that I haven't heard of before.
New Revised Standard?
Yep.
Okay. That's actually, the professor I have right now prefers just the Revised Standard for some of the stuff we're doing. But anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with you about the need for footnotes. I mean, for those that really wanted it, it's pretty easily found in a New Testament introduction. But then again, for every book, there are about as many different dates as there are commentators.
Right.
I would agree, though, with his ordering of at least the first several books. I would disagree with some of his assertions of Pauline authorship, but a lot of his dating, I think, is pretty well on. Although mm-hmm. Romans and Revelation and some of that I would disagree with.
Yeah, some of it he does make some very interesting choices, but we'll get into that. We'll get into that in just a moment. Yeah, and like you said, there's a lot of different. And I mean, this was like his life's work. He was a biblical scholar as his life's work, and yeah, there's a lot of disagree. And I've even read a Spong book where Spong completely disagreed with him about the dating of one of the. I think it was Luke Acts. He completely disagreed with him on.
Right.
All right. So I want to start out this week. The last several episodes, I've gotten to the reading very, very late, if I've gotten to it at all. I'd like to actually start out this week reading because I want to read from the beginning of the book, talking about the point of a chronological New Testament. So the way this always goes is I'll read from it, and you two can be the Statler and Waldorf in the theater and just interrupt me and heckle whenever you feel like it.
Very good.
All right. This is chapter one, a chronological New Testament, the evolution of the word. This chronological New Testament is the same as and yet different from the canonical New Testament. It contains the same 27 documents, but it puts them in the order in which they were written. The Gospels do not come first. Rather, seven letters written by Paul do. Revelation is not at the end. Second Peter is. And eight other documents that are later than Revelation. That was flooring to me. Honestly, I'd never really heard of that large of a number of documents written after Revelation. Right. I never heard of anybody put that.
Right. And I tend to be beholden to a theory that Revelation is earlier than even Borges puts it. I tend to believe that it's closer to 70 AD. Mm-hmm. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. But
more of a preterist interpretation.
Indeed. A semi-preterist, I would call myself, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So just to translate just a little bit for those listening, just so you don't have to be a biblical scholar in order to listen to this, there are four different, there's several different ways to interpret the book of Revelation. One of the way, I mean, futurist is the one that so many people and American Christians say, you know, it's left behind, it's the rapture, you know, all these things are going to happen in the future. There's also an interpretation that says, oh, these things happened already, or maybe they happened throughout time, like maybe World War II fulfilled some of it, or Antony and Mark Antony and Caesar Augustus revealed some of it, you know, at different times. That's a historicist interpretation. There's also an allegorical interpretation, which is, oh, it was never meant to be taken literally, in any way. It's just this spiritual picture, and it's meant to be taken as a spiritual thing, and it's meant to be allegory. And then there's this interpretation called the preterist interpretation, which says that all these things were fulfilled, or at least most of these things were fulfilled, in 70 AD. In 70 AD, there was a major, major historical event in biblical proportions that we don't get in our Bible. It mentions nothing about it in our Bible, and that is the fall of Jerusalem. This is where Jerusalem was taken over by the Roman Empire, and Jerusalem fell as a city. The walls were destroyed. The temple was destroyed, and the temple being destroyed in Judaism is a huge, huge thing because Judaism had to completely change and morph. So I didn't even mean to get into that much detail on that, but it's a fascinating subject. I would have called myself a preterist a year or two ago, but a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was a solid preterist at that time. I would put myself more kind of a preterist / allegorical at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about you, Jennifer? Where do you fall in on that?
Probably mostly the preterist side, where I see a lot of what he's talking about as referring to probably the big event in 70 AD that John just talked about.
Right.
And then, you know, but I mean, I do think obviously some of it, is probably still talking about, the second coming or whatever, but, I don't fall in with all that, left behind theology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that would be called a partial preterist viewpoint where most things were fulfilled in AD 70, but Jesus Christ is still going to return at some time.
Right. Yep, that's where I would put myself. Yep.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Okay. Back to the text.
Good.
And actually, that's not a wasted side note, because we are going to be talking about that a little bit later when we talk about 1 Thessalonians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, back to the text. Seeing the documents of the New Testament in chronological sequence illustrates and demonstrates a central theme of this book, namely that the Word, shorthand for the Word of God, evolved. By evolved, I mean simply that it developed and grew over time. Now, this is that statement by itself, that's kind of the central point of this book, and that's heresy to many, many people. That the Word of God, I mean, of course we know the New Testament or the Old Testament changed because it was written over 1,000 years, 1,500 years, you know, whatever it was. But the New Testament, many people believe it was written over the course of a single lifetime. And we don't normally talk about the New Testament evolving.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think so it's scary. I think it's really scary for Christians to consider if they haven't, because especially if you're coming out of that conservative evangelical background, you've been told inerrancy is everything, and to question the nature of the text in this way, to say that to allow for the way that it evolved. Well, all of a sudden you're entering a lot of man and human element into it, and mm-hmm. not allowing for this divine, you know, inerrant text.
Right.
And it's just, I think it's really scary for people to consider. And so they won't even go there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is definitely more of a risk. I mean, when you can't be certain about things, you're no longer on this solid footing, but, you know, I mean, the place where I'm at right now, I think if you're going to be certain about things, that footing was never solid. That was just an illusion underneath you in the first place.
Right.
Right.
I would rather have my eyes open.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Back to the text. For Christians, the Word of God refers to both a book and a person. As a book, it includes both the Old and New Testaments. Though Christians have often and wrongly thought of the Old Testament as having inferior status, it does not cease to be the Word of God because of the New Testament. Rather, the New Testament is an evolution, a development that does not leave the old behind. The Word of God, as the Bible evolved over a period of 1,000 years, most biblical scholars date the earliest written parts of the Old Testament into the 900s BCE, and the latest parts of the New Testament into the 100s CE. The Word of God as a person refers, of course, to Jesus. He is the Word made flesh, incarnate, embodied in a human life. Of course, he himself evolved from childhood into early adulthood and into and through his public activity. But also, and this is what a chronological New Testament illustrates, understandings of his significance and meaning evolved, developed in the decades and century after his historical life. The Word as book and as person is not static, but the product of a process.
So that's what makes me nervous.
Yeah.
When he's talking about the understanding of Jesus's significance and meaning evolving, that's what really makes me nervous. And I'm like, okay, where are we going with this? What are you saying? What do I think about this? And, you know, but yeah, to be completely honest, that sentence makes me the most nervous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I absolutely understand that. I can completely see where you're coming from. Go ahead, Jason.
One of the things that has inoculated me against a little bit of that fear is reading a little bit of Karl Barth, reading a little bit of some more progressive theologians in my time, and shifting my thinking from the Word of God being a book to the Word of God being Jesus. I mean, it's obvious in Christian theology that both are true, mm-hmm. but to emphasize Jesus himself as the Word of God, who is still present with us, depending on how you want to think of that, depending on, you know, and Borg would not be a literal resurrectionist.
Right. Correct.
But even he would emphasize, I'm also reading alongside our book, it's the Heart of Christianity, which mm-hmm. is basically his manifesto of progressive Christianity. And he still emphasizes the centrality of Christ and his active presence. I'm not sure, you know, how he thinks about that compared to the traditional understanding, but focusing on Jesus has kind of inoculated me a little bit away from some of those fears. But I'm not trying to discount yours, Jennifer, at all. But
right.
That's kind of my own transition.
Well, and that raises the question that I had when I was reading the part on Thessalonians. No, Corinthians, where he talks about the resurrection of the body. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, I think he says something in there about not needing it to be a literal resurrection of the body, but it's almost like he's talking about a spiritual resurrection as opposed to the physical resurrection. And
he would go for his own personal view, but he's not dogmatic about that.
Right.
He is personally, but he is not opposed to a literal resurrection. He would assert that it's not necessary. Now, myself, I would assert that it is necessary. That's kind of my line in the sand.
Right. And that's where I'm at as well. But if I wanted to read more about his view, would that be in that book with N.T. Wright you were talking about earlier?
I would probably go to The Heart of Christianity. But if you wanted to go on the whole focus more on Jesus, that would be the book. Jesus, Two Views, N.T. Wright and Marcus Borg.
Yeah, and it's specifically written where they both talk about each other's views. I mean, there's several books that, I mean, when I was on a big apologetics kick, when I was a young evangelical, several views that are like four views on hell and views
on salvation. You know? I have a lot of those books, yeah.
Yep. That's what when you're on fire for Jesus, that's the stuff that you read.
Sure. He's also, I think N.T. Wright wrote one with John Dominic Crossan also. Those would be two very good, compatible books that I would recommend on that progressive vision of Jesus.
Cool. Yeah, N.T. Wright does seem like one of a very few conservative theologians that's willing to cross the aisle.
Yes.
At least and have discussion.
Yes.
All right, back to the text. This process, however, he's talking about the process of evolution, changing of the text. This process, however, is not intrinsically about improvement. Later does not always mean better. Rather, as we will see, some of the later documents in the New Testament reflect a domestication of the radicalism of Jesus and early communities of his followers. Canonical New Testament and chronological. The canonical New Testament, in other words, the official ordering of the books in church Bibles, begins with the Gospels and concludes with Revelation. Because Jesus is the central figure of Christianity, it makes sense that the New Testament begins with narratives of his life, teachings, and passions. Thus, the Gospels are chronologically first in a biographical sense. Man, I'm messing every word up. I'm sorry. And because Revelation is about the last things and the second coming of Jesus, it makes sense that it comes at the end. Revelation and the Gospels function as bookends for the New Testament. Everything else comes in between. By putting these documents in a quite different sequence, namely the order in which they were written, this book presents a literary chronology, a panoramic view of how the ideas and stories of the New Testament changed over time. It also emphasizes chronology in a second important sense, namely that of seeing, reading, and hearing these documents in their historical context, the world of the first century and a bit beyond. Both of these emphases are the product of modern biblical scholarship. Its roots go back to the birth of modern thought and the Enlightenment of the 16th and 17th centuries. Though the Enlightenment began with science, Copernicus, Galileo, Newton, and so forth, it soon extended to other areas of inquiry, including the study of the past. It generated a historical approach to the Bible and early Christianity that emphasizes the importance of seeing its documents in their ancient setting. When were they written? What were the historical circumstances in which they were written? What did they mean in their ancient context? This historical approach to the Bible and the New Testament is not universally embraced by Christians. Those in churches committed to biblical inerrancy and a literal interpretation of the Bible reject much historical scholarship because it calls into question their understanding of the Bible as having a divine guarantee to be factually and absolutely true. Some Christians are unaware of the historical approach and thus neither reject nor affirm it, but it is taught in most universities and colleges and in mainline Protestant and Catholic seminary. So modern biblical scholarship has not led to a unanimous view. How do you say that word? it has not led to unanimous view about how to sequence all of the New Testament, which is what you were talking about earlier, Jason. There is a consensus about the basic chronological framework. And here he's got a bullet pointed out. The earliest documents are 7 of the 13 letters attributed to Paul. There is universal agreement that these 7 were written by Paul in the 5th. They are earlier than the gospel. The first gospel is Mark, written around the year 70. Matthew and Luke both, and once again, some people would date Mark earlier than 70. Matthew and Luke both used Mark when they later wrote their own gospel. Revelation, probably from the 90s, is not the last book of the New Testament to be written. 2 Peter is almost certainly the latest, from near the middle of the 2nd century. So that that 2 Peter is probably the latest, is accepted quite a bit in biblical scholarship. That it is near the middle of the 2nd century is probably not completely accepted in biblical scholarship.
Right.
In my evangelical seminary, the opinion was that 2 Peter was maybe written by Peter, but if it was written in a different way, a different manner. That was kind of one of the books that was said, well, if anything is written by somebody other than the author claimed, it's 2 Peter.
Sure.
Because it's so different.
Yeah, and Borg goes into in this book, and I've also heard in other sources before, the idea of plagiarism. You know, if we put somebody else's name on something today, then that's called plagiarism. You know, and it's taking credit where it's not really your thing. Somebody else wrote it, you know, but there's not really a concept of that before the printing press. You know,
that's correct.
But, you know, in the first century, there's not really a concept of that. So if you were writing and you were in the school of Peter, then you'd put Peter's name on it because you're thinking as Peter. You're wanting to honor your master at that.
Exactly. Pseudepigraphy, it's called in the trade. And one of the major works that biblical scholars read is the Old Testament pseudepigrapha, and it's almost certainly that none of the books are written by Moses or by Enoch or by any of the other people that are named, but they revered the character so much that they wanted to attribute the work to them.
Sure, sure.
Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, you know, different. It's a different time. You've got to think of it in the time that it was written.
Exactly. Contextual reading.
Yep.
On the topic of the different authors, though, the contested authorship of Paul, right, for some of the letters, I personally don't, it doesn't really bother me that much. I know it really freaks the conservatives out if you take it away from Paul, and I'm trying to remember why that is, why that bothers them so much. If you say,
because it's no longer inerrant.
Is that why does it have to be written by Paul to be inerrant?
Because the Bible says it's written by Paul.
Oh,
I mean, that's why.
All right. Yeah. That I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Back to the text. And so this chronological New Testament does not begin with the Gospels, but wait, did I go back too far?
I don't think so.
Nope. That's it. Okay. And so this chronological New Testament does not begin with the Gospels, but with 7 of Paul's letters. Moreover, the Gospels appear in a different order. Mark is first, not Matthew. It does not end with Revelation, but with several documents written later than Revelation. Within this consensus framework, there is also uncertainty about the dates and sequence of some documents. Though 7 letters of Paul are certainly by him and from the 50s, what about the other 6 attributed to him, but probably written a generation or two after his death? Are they from the 80s and 90s or from the early 2nd century? So also, how are we to date other letters? James, Hebrews, Jude, 2 attributed to Peter and 3 attributed to John. Most are dated, estimated, guesstimated to be from the 90s to the early 100s. How to sequence them is at best an educated guess. Should first, because there was no postmark. Should 1 Peter be before or after Hebrews or the letters of John? It's hard to know. But uncertainty about the sequence of some documents does not negate the twofold foundation of this chronological New Testament. The scholarly consensus that the chronological order and canonical order are different and that the general framework for ordering them is clear. The value of a chronological New Testament. Seeing and reading the New Testament in chronological sequence is illuminating, making many things apparent. starting with seven of Paul's letters, illustrates that there were vibrant Christian communities spread throughout the Roman Empire before there were written gospels. These seven letters provide a window into the life of very early Christian community. That's huge to me.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about and something that I definitely was never taught.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're so used to Matthew, Mark, Luke, John being first, you know? I mean, so you think, well, that's always how it was. You know, we heard these stories about Jesus and then it grew, but that's not how it was. I mean, especially because we put after the Gospels, we have the book of Acts, which is the story of the early church. So that's how it's naturally presented to us, is that you have the stories of Jesus and then you see how the church grew.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it makes sense from a literary standpoint, but it doesn't make sense from this chronological standpoint and the developing consciousness of Christ's position in the church. Although I would argue maybe even against Borg a little bit, that some of Paul's language in those seven non-contested letters is what we would consider a high Christology compared to even, you know, Mark's gospel, which was written much later.
Mm-hmm.
But we could go on about that all day. Maybe we will when we get to the Gospels.
Sure. All right, back to the text. Placing the Gospels after Paul's letters makes it clear that as written documents, they are not the source of early Christianity, but its product. The Gospel, the good news of and about Jesus, existed before the Gospels. They were produced by early Christian communities several decades after Jesus' historical life. Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I think he gets into this at some point, but
yes.
I would almost want to push back on that point to say they had the oral tradition, you know, that was, and that maybe that's what he's even alluding to when he's talking about
yes.
the early Christian communities. But they had the oral tradition that then the Gospels were most likely written out of.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that's what he's talking about. I mean, these stories obviously circulated beforehand. And that's what he's getting to in this point right here, is that these stories existed before they were written down and canonized.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Reading the Gospels in chronological order, beginning with Mark, demonstrates that early Christian understandings of Jesus and his significance developed over time. When Matthew and Luke used Mark as a source, they not only added to the Markan material, but often modified it. Seeing John separated from the other Gospels and relatively late in the New Testament makes it clear how different from them John's Gospel really is. Realizing that many of the documents are from the 90s and later allows us to glimpse developments in early Christianity in the late first and early second century. So I was gonna read more of this, but I see the time we're already at 33 minutes. So I want to skip ahead a little bit in here. There's another part that I had in blue. I'm gonna skip to this section that says chronology and historical contextualization. This New Testament has a second feature. It not only places the documents in chronological sequence, but also contextualizes them in their time and place. It emphasizes the importance and illuminating power of setting them in their historical context and seeking to discern their meanings in their ancient setting. Context is not the same as background. I recall from graduate school 40 years ago, books with titles like The Background of the New Testament and The New Testament in Its Background. But context is more than background. Context is the world in which we live. Where we grew up is not only the background of our lives, but the context that shaped us. For example, I was born in the United States not long before the middle of the last century and thus grew up in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. These decades not only contain the facts of my background, they also provide the context for the era that shaped, as have the decades since. Unlike background, context is interpretive or interactive. We live in a particular time and place, and that affects what we think and how we respond and act. To illustrate from the recent past, American racism in the 1950s and 60s was not simply the background for Martin Luther King's life, but the interactive context in which he lived and to which he responded. To imagine seeking to understand King's words and life by treating his time and place as a mere set of background facts rather than as the interactive context would be to misunderstanding what shaped him, what guided him, decisions he did, and even why he matters so much to us today. By viewing the documents of the New Testament in their historical context, we recognize that they were not written to us and for us, but to and for the ancient communities that produced them. They tell us how formative figures in early Christianity saw things within their historical context, their time and place. To try to read the New Testament without taking into account its historical context produces misunderstanding. What we read about is their then, not directly about our now. Contextualizing the documents means asking, what did Paul's letters mean to him and to the communities that received them? What was going on in those communities that led Paul to address the issues he did? What did the Gospels mean in and for the communities that produced them and to whom they were addressed? What did Revelation mean to the early Christian groups in Western Asia Minor, modern Turkey, to whom it was addressed? Not only do the New Testament texts come alive in their ancient setting, but we are saved from the fanciful misunderstandings that result from non-historical interpretations. For example, the book of Revelation tells us what some early Christians thought would happen soon in their time, not about what will happen in our time or some future time. Passages in the New Testament that affirm slavery and patriarchy and condemn same-sex relationships tell us how some of our spiritual ancestors saw things, not necessarily how we should see things. Of course, what they thought in their then matters, but it may or may not be normative for us in our now. Context matters.
That whole thing is so good. It's so good. And it's what I wish I could drill into people's heads. Because, you know, even in my background, people paid lip service to the idea that context matters, but they didn't go far enough with it. And they didn't really take that seriously. And one thing that really occurred to me, it was actually in the paragraph right before where you picked up reading again, where it was talking about how the authors of the New Testament, they didn't publish their works for like a general public. They were writing for people that they knew, and they weren't publishing for a general audience. And that goes into what you were saying. And it made me think about how, you know, they didn't know they were writing what was going to become our New Testament, right? Our Bible. And that, I mean, I think that even can kind of blow your mind if you're coming from this conservative place.
How would that be if Paul signed his letters, "Your servant Paul, parentheses, author of the Bible"?
Right. Yeah.
One of the things that makes a lot of people uncomfortable is considering that the New Testament, particularly, even more so than the Old Testament, is what we would call a sectarian book, meaning that there are a lot of conventions in the Bible that would only be apparent at first reading to an insider. There is language. There are things that Paul just glosses over, and he expects his audience to understand. The Gospels expect their audience to understand, probably a little bit less in the Gospels, but certainly in the epistles. There are things that only an insider will know. And that's why I rail against this whole concept of the Bible for anybody who picks it up. I mean, yes, there have been amazing testimonies of people who have picked up a Bible and have come to some sort of knowledge of God through it. Praise God for that. Mm-hmm. But for those people that who say, well, the Bible is self-explanatory, that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's nonsense. It presupposes certain documents, presupposed a great deal of knowledge, some of which has probably been lost to history.
Well, and it's interesting because we don't do this with other books, right?
Right.
You know, what I thought of, because you guys know me and my obsession with C.S. Lewis, so I immediately thought about how when C.S. Lewis writes all kinds of things, especially his nonfiction essays, he references all kinds of things he expects you to know about, all different literary allusions to classic literature that he grew up reading. I mean, he was immensely well read, and he expects that you are too, and that you know exactly what he's talking about. So that's the analogy I made in my head when you were talking about this, because the writers of the New Testament are, they are expecting that their audience, you know, has this, a lot of times, this Jewish background and understands and knows the Old Testament scriptures that they had available to them, the Pentateuch and all that, you know, the law. They expect that they had this super familiarity with that, with all of their culture and their customs. And, you know, so why, again, why do we not treat the Bible with the same kind of, I don't know, respect that we do for other literature, and realize that there's all of this richness and context that we need to go looking for the, you know, that the original audience would have had. So yeah, it's just really interesting to think about.
Yeah, that's a thought, Jennifer, that we do a disservice to the Bible by holding it to a different standard. That would make evangelicals very uncomfortable to hear something like that.
Yeah. Right. When a biblical author mentions an eagle, they do not mean the United States of America. When a biblical author says the trump will sound, they do not mean Donald.
No, okay.
The context makes a difference. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to go into there's a timeline in this book that's absolutely fascinating. And because it's a timeline, you know, it goes from point A to point B. And thus, it can seem, if you take it out of context, it can seem like it's just like, oh, I'm saying this is exactly when things were. And obviously, that's not what Marcus Borg just said in his introduction. But I do want to take some time to go over this timeline. And in the text, it's on page 31 and 32. And if you want to see this timeline and see what we're talking about, just look up, do a Google search for evolution of the word. And it's the cover of the book, basically. It's really fascinating. But actually, before I get into that, I want to drop a little bomb and just kind of walk away. Just drop a little hand grenade that's from the intro before we get into here, okay? This is a quote from page 22 of the book. Paul's conversion was not from Judaism to Christianity, but from Pharisaic Judaism to Christian Judaism. They were different ways of being Jewish. The division into two religions became later. But Paul became a Christian, didn't he? Jesus was a Christian, wasn't he?
Oh, no.
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's just such a simple statement. Paul did not become a Christian. Christianity started out. It did not. Jesus did not come to create a new religion. In fact, some people say if Jesus were here today, you know, seeing what we were doing, you know, he would roll over in his grave or whatever, you know, because he did not intend to create a new religion. Jesus was in the synagogues. Paul was in the synagogues. Paul was a good Jewish boy. Jesus was a good Jewish boy.
Right.
And we need, that's the context that this was created in. We need to understand that.
I agree. And then when you get this mix of Gentile and Jew and this whole complicated issue, you know, fighting over circumcision and all sorts of other practices, we don't have a context for this, because the church is what, 90%+ Gentile now, if not more. I mean, I'm being generous there. And, you know, that was not the case in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's dig into this timeline. Okay. So I'm going to read these point by point. First we have the 30. Okay. The timeline would start, you know, approximately zero or 3 BC or whenever it was, is when Jesus was born. In 30, the execution of Jesus. His followers continue his mission in the Jewish homeland, especially in Galilee. Conversion of Paul, circa 33 to 35. So he's putting that just a few years after Jesus' death. Mm-hmm. Christ's community is already in Syria in the Jewish diaspora beyond the homeland. In the 40s, the emperor Caligula orders the erection of a statue of himself in the Jerusalem temple, sparking massive nonviolent Jewish resistance. So we know that the Romans had emperor worship. You know, the emperors basically were God. Right. You know, so I mean, we know that it was there was a lot of unrest. I mean, you see it in every single movie, every single Easter movie, from Jesus Christ Superstar to The Passion of the Christ. You know, so we know that in our culture very well, the unrest that there was around the time of Christ. So imagine the Emperor Caligula putting a statue of himself, "Hey, worship me," inside of the Jewish temple.
Mm-hmm.
That's craziness.
Yeah, absolutely.
At this time in the 40s, Paul was in Asia Minor, which is now Turkey. Christ communities reached Rome. How, we do not know, because Paul wrote to them after they'd already existed. There's controversy about whether Gentile converts need to become Jewish, circumcision for males.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews are expelled from Rome in 49, and Paul enters Europe, which is Greece. In the 50s, Paul is in Greece and Asia Minor. Near the end of the decade, he goes to Jerusalem, where he is arrested and imprisoned and finally sent to Rome in chains. Perhaps as early as the mid-50s, a collection of Jesus' teachings is put into writing for the first time. This is a source that biblical historians call Q.
Mm-hmm.
And then at this time, in the 50s, the seven genuine letters of Paul, 1 Thessalonians, Galatians, 1 Corinthians, Philemon, Philippians, 2 Corinthians, and Romans. And that's the order that he puts them in.
Right.
In the 60s, Paul's a prisoner in Rome. The Emperor Nero blames Christians for a massive fire in Rome and kills many, including Paul and Peter, in 64 AD. So this is when Paul died. This is when Peter died. If you read some of the history about Emperor Nero, it's amazing. This is when Christianity wasn't really persecuted up until, well, I mean, they were in Judaism, because they tried to spread, Paul always tried to spread in the synagogue, and they didn't, the Jews didn't like that very much. You know, so Christians were persecuted in Jewish circles, but they weren't really by the Roman any more than the Jews were, because they were a sect of Judaism.
Yeah, that distinction went away around 84. That distinction of the legal status of Christians kind of got dismantled in the 80s.
Well, I think this event, when Nero blamed Christians for the fire in Rome, which really probably Nero started himself because he wanted to rebuild Rome in his image. I think that's what really started the persecution of Christians.
Hmm. Hmm.
Because, I mean,
a convenient excuse.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in 66, there's an armed revolt against Roman rule in the Jewish homeland. In the 70s, in 70, we talked about this already, Roman legions reconquer Jerusalem and destroy the temple, the only place of Jewish sacrifice. The end of sacrifice begins to transform Judaism. Probably the majority of the followers of Jesus live in the diaspora, even though many are Jewish. And diaspora means that you're outside of the central region of Jerusalem and Israel. And at this time is also when the first gospel, Mark, was written and started to circulate. In the 80s and onward, the center of Judaism in the homeland moves to Galilee. At this time, James, Colossians, Matthew, and Hebrews were written. Judaism and followers of Jesus begin to separate into two different religions. Hostility began between non-Christian Jews and Christian Jews grows. And I would almost think, you know, so you were talking about this particular period of time, Jason, when that the distinction really grew between what it means to be Christian and what it means to be Jewish. I would almost think that would seem to me to be an effort by Jews to distance themselves from Christians.
Oh, that's precisely what it was.
Yeah.
Also to limit the legal restrictions, because the Jews had legal privileges under Roman law. And with the distancing of the two sects, essentially at that point, those legal restrictions of emperor worship and all sorts of other concessions that were made by the Roman government were thrown off. And so that's where a lot of this persecution comes from, is the fact that they had lost this legal protection and exemption from much of the statutes.
During this time in the 80s, also the hostility between non-Christian, non-Christians, Jews, and Christian Jews grows. And the second and third generation of Christians struggle with issues of adaption to Roman culture. So we're in the 80s. Jesus died in the 30s, you know, so that's 50 years. And he's talking about second and third generation Christians. You got to remember, at this time period, we didn't have running water and indoor plumbing and Netflix. Right. You know, it wasn't the posh lifestyle that we live nowadays. And there was much disease and much mortality. So the generations did not last. You know, you might say a generation is 40, 60, even 70 years today. You know, although you probably wouldn't say a generation is that long. A generation is not really until one group dies. It's until one group kind of loses power and the next comes
right.
in. In the 90s, we have the earliest reference to Jesus in a non-Christian source, which is Josephus, the Jewish historian. Mm-hmm. At this time, John, Ephesians, and Revelation were written. The final part of the Jewish Bible is canonized, creating the three sections of laws, prophets, and writings. Now that was interesting to me. I'd heard that before, but I hadn't seen it put into this stage before, because we're talking about the Old Testament. And I would say, oh, well, we had 400 years of silence, right? You know, which we didn't right. really, you know, but that's a whole other thing to talk about, you know? So, I mean, I always was under the impression that that was canonized long, long before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
And then in the 100s, he places Jude and the three books of John. In the 110s, the earliest references to Jesus and Christianity in Roman sources, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny. Mm-hmm. And this is where we have the books Luke, Acts, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Peter, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And also in the 110s, there was an unsuccessful Jewish revolt in Egypt because of the tension between Jews and Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the 120s, we have the last canonical book of 2 Peter. In the 130s, there's a Jewish revolt against Roman rule in the Jewish homeland, brutally suppressed by the Romans. Surviving Jews are exiled from Jerusalem. This was between 132 and 135. Mm-hmm. Christianity is now largely in the Gentile world of the Roman Empire beyond the Jewish homeland, but perhaps the majority of Christians are Jewish in origin. So this is talking about 100 years after Christ.
Right.
Still, it seems like the majority of Christians probably were still from Jewish background, even though Christianity had spread by that time in just 100 years, had spread mm-hmm. far beyond the confines of the Jewish homeland.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's a really interesting timeline to me.
Mm-hmm. What was a surprise for you when you looked at the timeline?
Just seeing the whole thing as an overview and putting, I have kind of turned into a history buff just in the past few years. You know, it's never really interested me that much before the past maybe 5 years or so. And I've turned into a history buff, and just being able to see some of these things and when the books were written, you know, of course this was his theory about when they were written, you know. Sure. I mean, so other people have different ideas, you know, but just putting them all, putting pins on a timeline and seeing things like that, I think is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And especially because this is such a turbulent time in that part. Well, not like there's any time that's not a turbulent time in that part of the world.
Right. Yeah. Jennifer, was there anything that surprised you about the Borg's timeline?
I mean, I'm not overly familiar with all of the different dating. I know that it's different than, but basically whatever I was taught was the conservative scholars' right. dates. So I know that Borg stands in contrast to them on different points. Mm-hmm. So, it really, like I said earlier, it makes me want to dig deeper, look at the evidence for the different dating and, right. Because there, you know, there's always underlying motivations for mm-hmm. everyone, for, you know, their choices that they make in these things. So yeah.
The thing that surprised me the most was the dating of Luke Acts.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's the most controversial part of his dating.
I think so.
Spawn disagrees with him on that.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's fascinating to I mean, if you're open to reading outside your perspective, this is definitely something that I would recommend to a lot of people just to get a different perspective.
Yes. Yeah, without immediately dismissing it.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so for the last part here, I want to go through very briefly. There's five books. We read the first five books inside of this book, which are 1 Thessalonians, Galatians, 1 Corinthians, Philemon, and Philippians. So I want to go through very briefly on each one of these. And actually, the first one, 1 Thessalonians, the first book chronologically in the New Testament. And I mean, and that's significant that it's 1 Thessalonians. And we have what's the biggest thing that 1 Thessalonians is known for today in modern Christianity?
The rapture.
The rapture. Right? And So Borg says in this section, this is a very provocative quote, their expectation of Jesus returning soon was obviously wrong. It didn't happen. That's going to piss off some evangelicals right there.
Oh, yes.
So I want to read a little bit more, just a couple paragraphs. This is out of page 38 and 39. And this ties in with what we were or with the different theories of the book of Revelation. Borg says, it is important to know that rapture theology, the notion that true Christians will be taken up into heaven 7 years before the second coming and final judgment, is neither ancient nor traditional Christianity. It is thoroughly modern. It was conceived in the 1800s by John Nelson Darby, 1800 to 1882. An Anglo-Irish clergyman active in Britain and North America, he not only originated the rapture, but is also the theological ancestor of the widely known Scofield Bible, with its divisions of history into dispensations. Before him, no Christian had spoken of the rapture. Seeing this text in its ancient historical context dissolves the foundation of rapture theology. Paul was not providing detailed information about a second coming that is still future from our point in time, whose details are to be correlated with other biblical texts about the last thing, the second coming, last judgment, and final state of affairs. Rather, using imagery from his time, he assured his community in Thessalonica of one thing: we shall all be together. Whether he meant any of the details of the text to be understood literally is impossible to know and seems unlikely.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that turned me off of rapture theology was learning how new it was.
Yes.
It's sold as, you know, they'll take it back to Irenaeus of Lyon and they'll say, well, he believed in some sort of literal thousand-year reign, so therefore this is biblical and it goes back all that far, but not really. The whole mechanisms and the charts and things, I remember having a conversation with my wife not long ago and she was talking about how she was able to do the charts and all the things like that. And now I had never been exposed to all of that, but...
Oh, I did. I grew up
on the experience. I think that's some sort of divine child abuse, you know, when you're having those things.
That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thankful I was not, that was one thing I was not indoctrinated with.
Right. So, it takes a while to unlearn.
Yeah. It does. And honestly, that was the thing that this paragraph, Borg puts it in a paragraph. And I know a lot more details about this, about John Darby and the Scofield reference. I had a Scofield reference. I was given it when I graduated from high school, and when I was given the right hand of fellowship.
Uh-huh. What is that?
They handed out the Scofield reference Bible, and they gave us this. And basically, this John Darby in the 19th century is responsible for dispensationalism. He's responsible for the rapture. I mean, there were a few, you can find a few weird, you know, here and there, little fringe things in time before that. But this is the first time you can really see this idea of the rapture, you know? And so this thing of coming on the clouds and we'll be gone in a twinkling of an eye. nobody thought that was going to be rapture up until the 19th century. Nobody, even though Kirk Cameron knows that that's what it is now. You know, but yeah, this is the thing. Learning this, that this is such a new thing. This is what triggered my deconstruction.
Interesting. Wow.
This was the thing for me. And I went all sorts of places from there, but that's the first thing that really hit me.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that pushed me out of I was raised in the Assemblies of God. And when I realized that of the 16 major doctrines of the church, two of the four essentially hovered on the rapture, I realized how out of proportion their theology was.
Mm-hmm.
That tends to be central in charismatic churches. The rapture is very big in charismatic circles.
Oh, yeah. Well, all evangelicals, really.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. The more fundamentalists, you know, like Pentecostals are more fundamentalists than charismatics usually. And man, they're huge on it. In fact, there's a story about this Scofield Reference Bible. The reason why this rapture doctrine spread so much is because this was the first reference Bible of its type, and it was used to raise up a generation of pastors right after the Great Awakening.
Right.
So that's how this theology spread. That's why it's so pervasive right now, because the generation of pastors that had all these new converts, because at that time you didn't really go out to the movies. You know, you went to the tent revival and you know, you got the demons cast out of you, and that was fun. That was a nice, you know, that was how you had entertainment back then, you know, in the Bible Belt. and so that this Scofield Reference Bible filled a need at that time. And so it spread this dispensational theology. And there's stories about how it originally talked about cessationism was part of dispensationalism, and the Pentecostals didn't like that. And so they literally made a stink about it, and Darby took that out. Yeah. You know,
cessationism, cessationism was something I was taught. But so right after the part you were reading in the text was where he says, seeing the text in this way, one has to conclude that it is in an important sense wrong, because Paul expected the second coming soon and it didn't happen. And then I love the last two paragraphs of this chapter. He says, thus the first document in a chronological New Testament raises the central question of biblical interpretation that divides Christianity today. How are its documents to be understood? As coming from God in a sufficiently direct way as to have a divine guarantee to be true? If so, whatever they say is true or will someday be true. Or do they tell us what formative figures in early Christianity said in their time and place? The question is about the divine or human origin of the Bible.
That's so good.
If it is inerrant because of its direct origin in God, then it cannot be wrong. What Paul wrote about the second coming of Jesus will happen someday. But if it is the product of our spiritual ancestors, it tells us what they thought. It is not inerrant divine information to be integrated into a theological system, but expresses their understanding, conviction, and testimony. And this ties right into the Pete N stuff we're doing, looking at his book, The Bible Tells Me So, and what he talks about with the Bible being this, I think he uses the analogy of the incarnation. It's a human work, and it's got divine elements too, but it's not just this spoken, inerrant, divine text. It's got, you have to wrestle with all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I really liked those two paragraphs there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. I mean, it gets it right up front. I mean, it's going to piss off some evangelicals, right? And this is what we're talking about. If you can stomach reading something that's not, you're not necessarily going to say, oh, check off. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree. You know, there's going to be some stuff that's going to piss you off a little bit, and that's okay. You know, if you could read this book, it's incredible. It's amazing. It's got some great stuff. It'll broaden your horizon.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Four more biblical books. I want to just touch on each of them. You know, I wanted to dig in just a little bit on 1 Thessalonians because of that. But anything you want to say about that? About Galatians is the next one. the thing that really hit me reading through Galatians, this is such a beautiful manifesto of grace that has been hijacked to serve the law.
It absolutely. Really,
when you read through, and I mean, we're so used to picking apart verse and verse and verse and giving this proof text and this proof text. Sit down and read Galatians in one sitting. It's just like six chapters, right? It's not very long.
Yes.
Sit down and read it in one sitting. It'll take you half an hour, 45 minutes top, you know, just bathe in this. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
Absolutely. And it also discounts the whole thing that when you disagree with someone, you have to be so uber sensitive. I mean, Paul is at his most pissed off in Galatians. And, you know, I mean, 1 Corinthians looks like a love letter compared to Galatians. But
he goes back and forth in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah. But it's
he might seem a little manic.
Yeah, but it's because of this grace idea that you brought up that he's so upset that it's being perverted. And I'm just wondering what Paul would be writing to the church today. I mean, if his language would be even more pissed off than it was in Galatians.
Oh my God, I just noticed something. I just used the word grace on the podcast. So when Nathan Jennings was on this podcast, Nathan Jennings, Leo Hare were on it, and I think the topic was hell, you know, because that's the group, the posse of online spiritual misfits. That's kind of what it's about is people following the gospel of universal reconciliation or inclusionism, you know, and having a place to really work those things out. And Nathan was on, and he said, you know, he's been on the podcast three or four times, something like that. And he said, he's the guy with the Southern drawl. Some of you listeners who've listened to a lot of the episodes, but might not remember his name. He said the word grace. And I said, you know what? I mean, we're like 15, 20 episodes in at this point. You might be the first person ever to use the word grace on this podcast. And I think I just said it for the first time. I don't think I've ever said it before on this podcast.
Wow.
But that actually kind of surprises me because, you know, Reclaiming Christianity is about that part of it, right? I mean, focusing on the grace and the love aspect.
And I've obviously talked about that concept and the ideas, right? But just, I mean, the word itself can be kind of a churchy Christian-y word.
Yeah, I get that.
And it's been hijacked so much also.
Indeed.
First Corinthians.
Christ has been attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First Corinthians. What struck you about reading First Corinthians in this context?
I think the biggest thing for me, 1 Corinthians has always been one of my favorites, but reading it on the heels of others of Paul's writings really put it in a different context for me. It made 1 Corinthians 15 really pop.
Yeah.
And that's his description of the gospel and the resurrection.
It's the resurrection chapter. It's the earliest recorded treatment of the resurrection of Jesus.
That's right.
This is before we have gospels.
Pops.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what stood out to me too. It's so funny because I took a class in my undergrad Bible college on 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and my final paper, I think I got to choose kind of what chapter or topic I wanted to focus in on, and I did it on 1st Corinthians chapter 15, focusing in on this whole idea of the bodily resurrection and how important that was, you know, to believe that Jesus had a physical bodily resurrection and what that means for us. And I think it would be interesting for me now to go back and read that paper and see if I still agree with myself or see where I disagree with myself.
And because it's really easy to read into the text and make it say something it doesn't say.
Right.
Because for instance, in 1 Corinthians 15, first mention of the resurrection in all of Christian history, Paul does not mention an empty tomb. Paul's own encounter with Jesus is non-physical.
Right, right. That was a challenge to my thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not saying it didn't happen, or it's not saying Paul didn't say it happened, or Paul didn't think it was important, but it's just, yeah, we gotta challenge and see what the text actually says, not what we think that it says.
Correct.
All right, Philemon. No, so Philemon and Philippians, the last two here that we're going to talk about, he openly says, you know, these could be in either order. I really don't know which order to put these in, but they go here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both very short. Philemon is the only letter that's written to a person, not to a community. Now, that's if you say that Timothy is not,
right.
Yeah. That's if you say if that's not written by Paul. But if these are the authentic Pauline letters, then this is the only one written to a person.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul speaks very harshly towards hierarchy and slavery, which is radical in his day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The fact that he basically says, no, you as a Christian, you cannot have a Christian slave. And to think how radical that idea would have been at that time. And it makes me wonder, I don't know how it seems like we've domesticated Paul as well in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. And, it makes you wonder too, how Christians used the Bible to justify slavery in America.
Right.
And I'm sure in other places too, but it's like, how do you get around Philemon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And the last one is Philippians. The thing that struck me about this one is Paul wrote this. He was in jail when he wrote this, and it seems like it was going to be his farewell letter.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he thought, I mean, it wasn't his last letter. Romans was, at least according to Borg. Romans was the last one that he actually wrote. But he thought he wrote it like it was his farewell. You know, and honestly, I remember about 10 years ago when my grandfather died, that I read sections of Philippians at his funeral. It's very fitting mm-hmm. for a funeral.
Yeah. Yeah. It just some of the language in there, you know, and what most scholars, evangelical and progressive alike, would consider to be early Christian hymns, the Christ hymn in Philippians 2. I mean,
mm-hmm.
some of the most beautiful, it seems like he had picked some of his favorite, it's like a greatest hits, some of his greatest sentiments to put in there. So I agree with you about the thinking it was his last letter.
I mean, at this time, how many times had he been in jail for preaching the gospel already?
Right.
All right. Anything that you want to say about any of those books or just the book in general before we finish up here?
Just that I'm looking forward to discussing more. This has been a very productive study for me, and I look forward to more of it.
Yeah, if you want to, listeners, if you want to join in with us, you can purchase the book. It's not one that you get cheap. It's one that, you know, you'll have to pay 10, 15 bucks for it or whatever. It might be out of print. I'm not really sure. I got a used copy myself. It's available on Kindle also. It's called Evolution of the Word.
But the hard copy is available still. You can get it in print for like 15 bucks.
Okay. But even if you don't want to read along the book, you just want to read along the biblical text along with us as we're going through it in chronological order. The next episode is going to be about 2 Corinthians, Romans, Mark, and James. So the reading for next week, or not next week, a couple weeks from now, is 2 Corinthians, Romans, Mark, and James. So, where can people find you? Jennifer, where can people find you if they want to look you up?
My website, blog, jennifernyhart.com. I always spell my last name because it's not intuitive. It's N-E-Y-H-A-R-T. And then Twitter and Facebook as well. And the Theology Book Club that you tell people about all the time too.
Yep. Theology Book Club for Deconstruction and Reconstruction. That's where all three of us come from. That's where we do a lot of talking about books. And the book this month there is The Bible Tells Me So by Pete Enns, like Jennifer was talking about. Jason, where can people find you?
Facebook is the best place to find me. That is where I'm at most active. I am less on the social media than most, but Facebook is my method of choice.
Alrighty then. So thank you both of you for being on the podcast, and I will see you again in a couple weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Sounds good.
All right, so let me close up now. So next episode, once again, is going to be Evolution of the Word Part 2. There's not going to be any other podcast before that one, not a Battlestar Galactica one. If you got freaked out by that last time, I'm sorry. Just showing up in the feed like that. Evolution of the Word Part 2, we're going to be going over 2 Corinthians, Romans, Mark, and James. The book club that Jennifer talked about, in April, the book is The Bible Tells Me So by Pete Enns. May, we're going to pick up with the podcast again on the book Why I Left, Why I Stayed by Tony and Bart Campolo. And the June book is Searching for Sunday by Rachel Held Evans. You can be on the podcast. You can join us on the book club. Just go to reclaimingchristianity.net. There's contact information right there. Or you can send me an email at johnweldy@gmail.com. If you would like to sponsor this podcast, you can go to patreon.com/johnweldy. You can also find us on Our Bible app, a Bible study app and community for progressive Christians. Check it out at ourbibleapp.com. So we come to the end of another episode, friends. And I want to say once again, the most beautiful thing that you can ever be is you. Do what you love. Love what you do. Thanks for listening.